Welcome to the Grappling Discourse podcast. I'm your host, Matt Scaff, and today I'm joined by one of my good buddies, Stephen Aiken. Stephen is a black belt under Boogie Martinez. He has his own gym, 10th Planet Perry in Georgia. Stephen, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. I want to start just by asking how you found jiu-jitsu and MMA in Georgia, and then what brought you out to San Diego, where you ended up earning your black belt under Richie Boogeyman Martinez.
Oh, all right. Well, first, I guess, man, thanks for having me on, Scaff. I'm one of the listeners of the podcast, as much as, you know, being someone that you would have on to interview is really cool. So it's really nice to be on the Grappling Discourse. Thanks for having me. All of that is quite a long, like 13 year story, I guess. I was in this town called Bainbridge, Georgia. That's where I grew up. It's my hometown. It's a pretty small town. We didn't really have much there to do, not much opportunity and different things like that. So at about, I think I was right at 25 years old or so, and had kind of just been consistently like messing up and not being like the person that I knew I could be. Couldn't really hold down jobs, wouldn't really like commit to stuff for whatever, like, you know, for whatever reason I would have in my head over and over again. I could never just like settle. So I was like, I had this job where I had the opportunity to sit on a computer a lot, which was kind of fun. And I was making money to a degree, but I was also like eating all day, drinking like 2 liters of soda every day, just sitting at this computer job. But I did always have like an affinity for fighting and martial arts, and like more so probably pro wrestling, I would say, than actual martial arts, because I never really had access to martial arts when I was a kid. So it was more of a pro wrestling fantasy, I think. Like, just wanted to make it to be in like in the WWF or the WCW or whatever kind of stuff like that, more than the UFC, because I really didn't have any access to seeing a lot of the UFC stuff until I was a little bit older. And then, you know, kind of about that same time is when I realized that wrestling wasn't real, and UFC or fighting, MMA, whatever they called it back then, was like real fighting. And so that kind of got my attention, you know, and tried to like follow it as much as you could. But I literally lived like way out in the country, like on some dirt roads. Like, you had to take a couple of dirt roads to get to the dirt road I lived on. So we didn't have internet. We barely had TV, like 3 or 4 channels and stuff like that. So like, I wasn't really tuned in as a kid and stuff like that to anything except for like being out in the country for the most part. But so I got in this job as like a 20 something, and like got on the MMA forums, like Sherdog specifically, and was just on there a lot, and was like, man, I really would like to do this if I thought I knew how to find someone that would teach me, or a place to even do it. Like, I want to be a fighter. Like, I was kind of known for like fighting in like club situations, or just at school as a kid or whatever. I was just angry a lot when I was a kid, and people would try to like, I guess, bully, for lack of a better term, but more verbally bully me, because I was always a bigger kid, because I was like always chubby and we were pretty poor. So it was like an easy target. And so I figured out that I could like punch people once and they wouldn't really bother me anymore. So that was kind of mostly how it was. It wasn't really like fighting where it's like hurting people, but it was more like, as soon as anybody would start really like teasing me or something like that, I would be willing to go ahead and just fight about it. I didn't want to sit there and deal with the verbal stuff, because I couldn't win that battle as a kid. So I'd always been like interested in fighting and thought I was good at it, or could be good at it, or, you know, and had those pro wrestling kind of dreams. And then I don't know if anybody remembers, but there was this school. It was in San Bernardino, California. It was really like, I don't even know how popular it was to other people, but they were offering scholarships to guys to come do MMA there. This was like 2008, So like right at the height of when the UFC was like really booming and all those things. And it was also a college that was going to have degrees for like sports degrees or whatever, like coaching or business management or different, you know, within the sporting industry. And so naively, to some degree, or just not really caring or whatever, I was just like, kept talking to this coach, and he was like, yeah, if you'll come out here to a tryout, we'll run you through a tryout or whatever, and then we'll just kind of see what's up from there. And so like, I just decided then, I was like, all right, well, I'll get a plane ticket and rent a car and like, I'll go do this. You know, I'd never been on a plane before, like at all. And so just this right here, I just like literally bought the flights, rented a car, and like flew to LAX to go do this tryout in San Bernardino, which was like not LA. Like in my mind, I was like, hey, I'm going to LA. You know what I mean? I'm going to go down. This is where I thought I was going to be. But it's actually San Bernardino, which is not good for a lot of reasons. Specifically, I mean, there probably are some good parts there, but mostly it was not good as far as safety and stuff like that. But I guess kind of a little bit more on that to a degree later. But like, so I got there and got to this tryout, and like, basically it was just a physical, you know, like a physical conditioning tryout where they were making us do a bunch of extra, like we didn't even do any fighting stuff at all, basically. So of course I was like 380 pounds at this point. So like I said, I was just eating and drinking sodas and stuff, sitting at this desk all day. And so like, it was really the stupidest thing ever to go to this tryout like that. But I just wanted to, and I was just like, didn't know what else to do with myself. And so like, guys were not finishing certain stuff, and then I was getting done like much later than they were with the exercise or whatever, but I just kept going. And like at a certain point, I would like have to run off the mat and like go throw up, and I would throw up and I'd run back onto the mats or whatever and try to finish the drills and do whatever I had to do. And more guys would kind of just drop out. And so I would be just back out there doing the thing. And I don't know how many times I was like throwing up, but it basically ended up to where I was almost just like crawling the last part of the mile, like sprint that we had to do to finish or something like that. And I was just like, man, I know they're not going to take me. I know they're not going to let me do this, but I'm just going to at least leave here like knowing that I tried my best at one thing ever in my life, like for sure. And so when I got up, I kind of like caught myself, got myself together, and I went upstairs to where the coach was. And he was like, hey, you know, you're awful. You're in terrible shape, you know, just really bluntly the truth, you know, but was like, with your attitude and that effort, I think there's a lot of possibilities if you can keep that up. And so if you want to, we would offer you like one of the spaces here on this team and like a scholarship to the school. So it would be cheaper to stay there. And that would also cover like a dorm room situation. And so I was like, hell yeah, like I'm in. And so I went back home, kind of quit my job. I didn't really have a bunch of stuff anyway. So I kind of got rid of the stuff that I had, minus a few bags of clothes and the Xbox. And I just kind of left shortly after the first of the next year. So that was like, the tryout was in August. And so then I had like 3 months, and I went out to stay in San Bernardino. And so, yeah, so first flight was out to LA, and second flight was back home. Third flight was back out there again, this time just to stay. So it was like a one-way flight. It's terrified. Got picked up by one of the people from the school and took to my, quote, dorm room, which was an apartment, because the dorms actually weren't ready. And like, there was two girls named Jessica and a guy named Abraham that were my roommates, who I had never met, talked to, or anything. And I'm just this kid, not even a kid, this adult male from South Georgia. And they're all like 19 or 20, I think, at the most. So it's just kind of funny that situation. But through that, man, I trained my ass off. And that's how I got in touch with like martial arts. And to me, I was going to go out there and be like a boxer. I was always like a Roy Jones fan and thought that was going to be the way that I was going to win a lot of my fights, is by like out punching people. But within the first any time, I got beat up by some small people using jiu-jitsu, I really started getting curious about what that was and how best I could utilize that, because it seemed a lot easier that those guys got by a lot easier than the other guys were when we were just kind of fighting each other. But I didn't know anything, you know, and I was also like 380 pounds. So I had to like first learn how to stand up and even not just, you know, die from rolling, period. So I was the typical like awful shape white belt guy who also in one of my first classes headbutted one of my training partners in the chest to make him open his guard because I thought it was legit. I didn't know it was MMA class, but I didn't know you couldn't do that. You know, I had been watching like old UFCs, I guess, and not really, like I said, I wasn't as in tune with like the modern, the modern world outside of where I lived. Oh man. But that's why I try to give people a little bit of grace when they come in and they're like, I'm going to be a world champion fighter. It's like, all right, guy, I hear you. But, you know, maybe they will, because all people need sometimes is that one chance. But from there, I fought. And that out there was where I did the X arm thing I talked about, the arm wrestling where they're punching and kicking over the table, the pilot for that, to make some money. They paid us to do that. So a couple of teammates and myself and a couple of other guys from other teams just kind of did this thing. Man, I was working at the gym, opening and closing the doors basically every night, mopping the mats and everything, just like trying to earn my keep. And I had a couple of fights against guys, like now looking back, they were just like walkovers. Those two first fights I ever had, only one of them is on my record and it's listed as an amateur fight, but he already had like six pro fights before that, but he lost every one of them. So I didn't know I was going to be able to beat him though, which is an interesting thing about looking at people's records. Also, when you look back at like the first fights people had, because like that guy was like 0-5 or whatever, but in my mind, I had never fought at all, you know, so any experience, and I just went straight pro because there was no amateur at that point. It was illegal to do amateur MMA. So I just went straight pro, but thankfully they got me a couple of easy fights. And then the third fight, I fought Dan Severn out there. And that's how I got my blue belt. Like I went up and fought Dan Severn, lost the decision. It wasn't a great fight, you know, but it was cool and it was good to do. And like earned a lot of respect from people because I went out there and did it and didn't just get mauled and pushed over. I learned how to use an underhook from the bottom after that fight. Because that was how he kind of beat me. He just held me down in side control with the underhook. And I never even learned how to like get the underhook back from bottom side control until my third professional fight against Dan Severn. But I was really tough, man, and game and went hard. But sometime after that, that was when the market was going bad, like 2008 or so or nine, like the housing market, real estate crashed. Well, this guy who was funding the school was actually a real estate guy, and like so all his money disappeared, so then all of our money comes to support us disappeared. So I tried to make it for a while, like couch surfing with teammates and trying to find odd jobs and different things like that, and eventually it just kind of ran out and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't make it anymore. So that was when I went back to Georgia and ended up moving in with Mandy. She was in college in Valdosta, and we had already been kind of talking and seeing each other long distance for a little while. And so I just moved to Valdosta where she was in college at, and there was an MMA school there. And so I just kept going there as a blue belt. I was the head jiu-jitsu coach at this MMA school that I was teaching at, because there wasn't really a lot of like good jiu-jitsu around yet. You know that this was like 2010 or 11, I guess. So like same thing kind of like in Alabama was the same thing in like Georgia. There was only a couple of black belts at the most outside of Atlanta, you know? And so I would travel and go pick up information and come back and teach it to the guys that we were training with. And I was fighting and working like odd kitchen jobs or whatever, cooking. So that way it would like accommodate my fighting schedule. And then that way, when I came back with black eyes and like stitches and cuts and stuff, I was just in the back in the kitchen, so I didn't have to worry about it. They didn't really mind too much. So I couldn't really have like a job where my face had to always be like good, because I always got cut a lot. And then from there, Mandy she graduated and got a job with Geico. And then we moved to Macon, which is how we got this middle Georgia connection now, like Perry's just south of Macon. And we lived here for about 3 or 4 years while she worked at Geico. And that's actually how we got to San Diego. She's a like a kick-ass person at anything she wants to do. So she just got promoted, and was like, hey, do you want to move to San Diego? I got an opportunity, and I was like, hell yeah. But I was really heavy in the gi still a lot and doing MMA. So at first I still didn't find 10th Planet at that point. I won't say anybody's specific names, I guess, but I tried a couple of different gyms out there and just didn't fit in with them or whatever the case was, I guess. Like I was trying and just wasn't quite working for me. And someone invited me over to some sparring for MMA at 10th Planet San Diego on a Friday. And so I went, did some sparring or whatever, met the coaches, met Boogie that day. And then I went back another time and I got to roll with Boogie that day. Like he was just like, hey, come roll. You know, it was like a jiu-jitsu class before the MMA sparring or training. And he was like, you know, he just rolled with me first. And my experience in a lot of other places was like guys would send several of their students out first to kind of soften me up. And then they would come in and try to go all hard. And you know what I mean? Because I'm big and I was already a brown belt at this point and had 18 professional MMA fights or whatever. So, you know, it's not an easy task if you see me, I guess, walking into your gym. You know what I mean? Like some guys just don't have that. I don't know. Their ego is not strong enough, I guess, to go out there and just see what's going to happen by rolling with a guest like that. But Boogie did. And that was the first thing that really caught my eye about him, specifically besides like the stuff that I'd seen, you know, on the internet about him. But like as a person, it's like he didn't send anybody else out first. He came first. And he kicked my ass like pretty bad. Tapped me probably 6 or 7 times in a 5-minute round. And I was just like shook, you know, and I hadn't been done like that in quite a while, I don't think. And so I was like, there's something to this. I want to at least learn how to like beat it. You know, I want to figure out what this guy's doing so I can at least like not let this happen to me again. And everybody there was cool. I'd never trained any of the 10th Planet stuff before. I'd seen it online or whatever. So basically had the same impression most people have that see the system without being trained into it. And you just don't understand some of the fundamental parts. And so you think it's not like legit. So I had some of those same misconceptions until I got there. So I wanted to train. And once I started getting into it, man, I was just, I never, after a little while, I never put the gi back on hardly like again in years. Like it was just almost like instantly once I got there. And so I just decided to join their team, signed up, started paying dues, joined the MMA team, started training. Like I trained every day, like 5 or 6, 7 days a week a lot of times. When we moved out there, Thomas, my son, he was just a year old, And I was a stay-at-home dad. It's from the time he was born, Mandy was like, she took care of me. And so I got to be a stay-at-home parent. And so I trained and took Thomas with me everywhere. So he's grown up in the gyms. And same thing in San Diego. That was another big part. When I took time, he had to go with me to train or I couldn't go. You know, like I wouldn't be able to go. And so a couple of the places I went, people were like, they didn't say anything directly, but they had comments about me bringing my kid to training. And I was like, well, I mean, if I need to do this, and if you said you want me on, you know, to be on the training team or whatever and be here at this time, this is literally the only way I can do it. And so it just didn't work out. But at San Diego, like there were other kids, like other parents were training, kind of. And like some of the other coaches like would go by and like sit with Thomas a little bit while he was like literally on the edge of the mat when I would be sparring and rolling for like, you know, a couple of classes in a row. He would give me about two classes in a row some days before he would really need to get out and like go do something else or whatever. But he literally grew up in the gym there with me, watching sparring, watching all the classes and stuff. So they really like, without that, I definitely wouldn't have made it to here now, I guess. So yeah, that's like the somewhat long, but definitely very short version of that story.
Well, I want to add, there's a million things I could ask, but I'm really interested in this because I know a lot of guys deal with this, is being a bigger guy in jiu-jitsu, right? Especially you're going to different schools, whether you were a blue belt, because back then there were so few black belts. I mean, if you were rolling up to a school as a blue belt, you might be the guy teaching the classes. And then you're a brown belt going out to San Diego and to other places trying to find a gym. A lot of guys see you and they're like, I don't want to train this. Like, I don't really want this guy. You know, I don't want to train with this guy. What, I guess first is what's it like being like a bigger guy in jiu-jitsu? And how how do you find a home as a bigger guy in jiu-jitsu? Because again, there's a lot of places, you know, that a bunch of small guys and they don't want to roll with you. They won't make eye contact with you. We're lucky here. We've got, you know, you've been to our gym. We've got all these giant guys. So they all fit right in and they all, you know, love what we've got going on, you know, back in our big guy corner, you know. But what's that like? And what are some strategies, I guess, to really kind of find your way as a bigger guy in jiu-jitsu?
You know, it's interesting because like the first several years of training, I was really mostly worried about just fighting, you know. So jiu-jitsu, when you're fighting, can be very simple, you know, in a lot of ways, because you're mostly looking to set up and be in control and on top and striking ranges and stuff. So I was able to kind of use a rougher style and had MMA as an excuse for it quite a bit. But then definitely as I got higher ranked, I definitely saw where people would not want to roll with me or train hard with me and different things like that. And I didn't quite understand it at first because I would never intentionally like hurt a training partner and stuff. And so I just didn't really have like a reference for what it was like when someone really was like just that much bigger than you. You know, what if I really just like put my weight down? So there was a few years when I had that like realization that it was like, oh, I'm really like putting too much weight on people, that I spent time not putting my weight down on people. And so to one degree, I think it hurt my ability to be like a heavy staple kind of person in a lot of ways. But I did learn how to like play jiu-jitsu a lot. And so I don't know that a lot of big guys play jiu-jitsu. I think a lot of guys still just rely on being bigger and stronger and like your body's too big for certain things to like, if, you know, one of the interesting things that I've seen for myself and from other people is like, there was a realization one time where I thought I was really good at like opening people's guard, but in reality, I was just too round. And so once I lost enough weight to be at a healthier weight, people could actually close their guard. And so I couldn't actually break the guard. I was just being too big sometimes. So that was something that I, you know, just like a bunch of little things like that came up over time. And then I was always aggravated, and I still kind of do sometimes get aggravated by that thing that even from Joe Rogan, I guess, is the main one that says it about, if you want to learn jiu-jitsu, you got to learn it from a small person, you know? And it's like, I mean, maybe if you're a small person, that's who you've got to learn it from, or maybe not. Like, I learned a lot of jiu-jitsu from small people, and I use it not exactly the same way, but I use it in the same like way that I would use it, you know, based on my abilities and my strengths and my weight, you know. So I think there's a difference between when you're trying to be extra heavy on people and you're really like trying to be winning a competition style of jiu-jitsu that I need to play. But then I've always had, I guess not always, but once I got close to purple belt, I really started embracing that like lighter style and wanting to prove that I could do the movements that little people do, and that it wasn't a size issue. It was a limit on everybody's mentality issue. A lot of people will be like, oh, big guys can't do this or whatever. And I think they're lying. Because, or they just don't know. Maybe they're not lying. They're just ignorant, you know, to what people can do, just because they don't understand how to do it. And that, you know, it's just something that it takes time for us. Like, for instance, rubber guard was really hard for me to get at first because I was already a brown belt. And you've heard it, and I think I've heard you guys talk about it on here too. If you don't develop that early in your game, it's really, really, really hard to develop it later. And so I was already a brown belt when I got exposed to a good rubber guard system that could work. And so it took me like 3 to 4 months probably of like diligently trying to even get to like New Jersey and the meat hook. And then maybe like another 3 to 4 months just to get that triangle from the meat hook, you know? And that was the first in path that I had. And it took me a year probably just to get that path to where I could actually use it on people in a real role, you know? Mm. So I think some things are harder because it mechanically does have to play out a little bit differently. But then sometimes things are easier for us because of that weight also. Because like one thing was interesting, when I go to other people's like pressure passing stuff, if a smaller person is teaching pressure passing, I don't usually get to go through all the steps that they do because my person is letting me pass before I have to go through as many like checkpoints, because the pressure's already, if I'm doing it correctly, the way that the instructor is typically wanting me to, the pressure's too great, you know, and they're begging me to pass the guard at that point. So it's interesting like that, you know what I mean? Like, and so I don't know, longevity says get a playful style anyway, right? When you're training, don't always try to be like big, strong, heavy or whatever. But I've made the mistake of doing that in Decatur. And one of those guys in Beef Alley just like got the side control, and he literally put his shoulder on my jaw for like 6 minutes. He didn't move. And it was like, oh my God, I'm literally just going to, he's like, my face is just going to break under this one shoulder pressure in a second, you know? So like sometimes that gets me in trouble with other people, and I have to like snap back into heavyweight mode. But overall, it's just jiu-jitsu, you know? It's just moving with the energy either to and fro or whatever, left and right or east and west or north, you know, however you want to look at it. If they push, I can either resist or I can like go back a little bit to the end of that pushing range. and, you know, vice versa.
Well, I think, so you mentioned Joe Rogan, right? I think his statement of you have to learn jiu-jitsu from a small guy is very, it's wrong. And especially because I've dealt with this a few different times, right? I'm 160 pounds. I'm your typical small guy black belt, right? And I've had students who were 225 and over that I've really struggled to communicate certain techniques with, especially in the beginning. I think when a student gets to purple belt and beyond, we start to speak the same language. They know how to move their bodies. They know what's going to work for them. They know how to make the adjustments that they need to. But heavyweight white belts, I struggle sometimes to teach them things because I just don't understand, you know, some of their, you know, difficulties in movements, or, you know, or I have a hard time kind of, again, understanding how to adapt a technique to make it work for them. And so I think it's crucial to have at least a big guy mentor, you know, a purple belt in the gym that can take white belt big guys under their wings. That can kind of go, hey, you know, I get it. This small guy saying, do this, this, and this, you don't need to do that. You only need to do this. And that's been a really eye-opening for me in kind of realizing that, man, I think big guys need big guy teachers.
I think to a degree that's definitely, I don't say definitely, because like I said, I spend a lot of time under smaller people as an instructor. And so it took, having smaller instructors, I guess, like Bubby Mitchell, for example, here in Macon, he's, I don't know if you know Bubby, black belt under Jukau. And he's like 140 pounds at the most, a lot of times, I think, and he's five something, you know, pretty short guy. And so a lot of the stuff I picked up from training with those guys, you know, specifically being in there with them. And like, what I think what you've got to do, and like everybody's got to do, is learn to adapt what the person is telling you to what you're capable of. Like, only you really can know what you're kind of capable of to a degree, right? But you gotta, like I said about the rubber guard stuff, you gotta try it though. You gotta be diligent in your practice to actually see if it's gonna work. Because you can't just be like, oh, didn't work today, I'm just gonna throw that away. Because it's just not how that's just not how jiu-jitsu works, you know.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And now thinking back to your time at San Diego, so you come in as a brown belt, you finally find a home there, and you learn under the tutelage of Richie Boogeyman Martinez. What have you picked up from, like, I should say, how has Boogie impacted your jiu-jitsu and the way you teach jiu-jitsu and the way you think about being, you know, a teacher and now a leader of your own gym?
So it's a really interesting thing that another concept that I kind of developed over being there with Richie. Like, Richie was always, he's a good teacher in the gym, you know, as far as like instruction, but he's definitely always been the guy that's like the lead from the front guy, and was out there really like showing his art and like trying to prove what he was teaching in class every day out there on the competition scene. And whether he won or lost, he always came right back to work, you know, with a mostly positive attitude. You know, we all have days, but you know what I mean? Like when you're striving and you're struggling and you don't have it doesn't go the way you want it to go, no matter who you are, you struggle, you know? And that was one of the hard things to kind of accept too, was that someone like Richie is human and he's not like bulletproof and things get to him too. And you know what I mean? Stuff like that. Like I'd never really been around someone that I got to know that as well as I got to know Richie, who was also, you know, a moderate, at least probably a pretty big, I guess, jiu-jitsu celebrity in the world. So seeing a lot of that and seeing how he dealt with that stuff was one that I think that as much as anything is what helped me get over a lot of the internal like problems I had always dealt with. I was always like I ended up at about 75% win-loss ratio in MMA. It was like 12-6 with a no contest. And some of that came down to just like not being mentally in the right space when I was doing a lot of it, not doing it with the right mindset or stuff like that, you know? And like being around Richie and seeing how he would handle that adversity of taking a loss and then coming right back and then going to work and fixing some of the issues was always really like something that inspired me and made me want to do more, you know, and do better. But then another like thing was Richie taught a certain set of classes. And then the other instructor was Gabe Tuttle. Gabe was only a purple belt then. So I was a brown belt coming in. Gabe was he's lighter. He's smaller than Boogie. But they're built similarly. Like if you look at them as far as weight classes, they're both like lanky and rangy. So I think that's one of the reasons that they like vibe so much together is because even though, you know, there's a big weight difference, they're in their weight categories built similarly. So that's another thing too. You could have a thicker, smaller 160 versus a rangier 160. So that guy may need to be with me a little bit more. Shorter versus taller, I think a lot more has to do with it than weight. I think that attribute people don't overlook it, but I think as far as like who you need to try to be like a lot of times, so to say, maybe mimic people who have your body type, even if they're lighter or heavier, versus someone who weighs the exact pounds you weigh, because that could be wildly different, you know. And so Gabe was a purple belt teaching classes. And so I would just go to a lot of his classes, and we just kind of developed a really cool relationship where he was really open to me asking him a lot of questions. And not that Richie wasn't, but he was just busy and everybody wanted to ask Richie a lot of questions then, you know. And so I could just get Gabe kind of to myself and just ask him a bunch of questions. And he helped fill in a lot of the like fundamental gaps that I was having coming in as a brown belt trying to pick up the system, you know. So I spent a lot of time getting to know Gabe too. And it took some whatever for me, like, you know, to other people be like, you're a brown belt, why are you in a purple belt's class or whatever? And it's like, man, I'm learning a ton in this class. This guy is teaching me a bunch of things that I don't know, you know? So like I think a good purple belt can teach a lot of people stuff, even brown and black belts for sure, that don't know that purple belt's game or the game that they're trying to show. So being there and seeing that kind of stuff, having different instructors in the same room, kind of where we had to like agree and disagree on stuff, you know, at the same time was interesting. Because not everybody agrees, you know, like you'll like it a certain way and I would like to do it another way. And so if we both can do it in competition that way and it's successful, then I guess nobody's wrong, you know? So like, I think that was the biggest thing, was like, I was able to see like a bigger picture, you know? And slowly, I kind of worked myself from the back of the room to the front of the room. You know, when I got there, I was getting heel hooked and like leg locked by blue belts and stuff like crazy. Like just because I had no idea, because I just got, you know, I was recently a brown belt before I got to San Diego. And so I just really got to the point where I was like, all right, now I can learn leg locks because I've been deemed so by the IBJJF. You know, and so just like getting out of that mindset was a big thing too, to where I realized, you know, it wasn't all about that game. That game wasn't everything, you know. It really opened up my style. It really opened up me as a person, because I felt like they let me be myself, you know, and I was able to play kind of the way I wanted to, you know, and then within reason, I would get checked, Boogie wasn't afraid to like tell you some stuff, you know, if he disagreed or thought that something was wrong, you know. And like, I got checked a couple times, for sure. One time after a Naga in Vegas, I had like a bad attitude because I lost on points. Because I tried to do a triangle and the guy passed my guard or whatever, and then he got the points and then recovered. And he was like a former UFC guy, and so I really wanted to beat him. Like, Boogie was there in my corner and stuff. I was new to the team, kind of like representing for the team for the first time, kind of deal. The other guy was like Jeff Glover was his coach, and so I put all this stupid pressure on myself for no reason, you know. And then I had a bad attitude right after it because I was like just frustrated. And like, he immediately called me out. I was like, nah, dude, you're not gonna act like that if you're gonna compete for us. And I was just like, oh man, dude, you're totally right. Like, I didn't even mean to do it. You know, it's not really my character usually, but for whatever reason, I put so much pressure on this moment because I never like thought that that was how I was gonna end up with my game. You know, I never really saw myself ending up out in San Diego, out in one of those like really powerhouse teams where, you know, you hear about the room on, you know, on Joe Rogan or whatever. He would always talk about the rooms in San Diego. And then he would talk about the breakdancing brothers that were in the, you know, Eddie had found that were just killing people and lighting people up or whatever. And then finally I was there. I was a part of it every day. And it just became normal, you know, to be one of those guys like that. And it was really fun to be able to still work my way through, you know, because as a brown belt, I still, you know, like I trained full time the whole time I was there, basically. And, you know, finally earned my black belt under Boogie, and was really surprised when I got it, you know, and very, very proud to have earned that, and that they gave me, you know, the respect and they accepted me fully, you know, that meant a lot. Because getting other belts is one thing, you know, as you come in. But coming in already as a brown belt, I didn't get demoted or anything or whatever. He always respected the fact that I was a brown belt. And you know, it was never like a now you're a 10th planet white belt kind of deal. But I just spent my time, you know, at brown belt for 4 or 5 years, I guess, or something like that at brown belt. And dude, I just competed. Like after I got hurt the last time trying to do MMA, like the fights. Okay, so yeah, I retired from MMA. Boogie helped me retire from MMA too. That's another thing. Like mentally, he helped me retire. Because I was just like taking damage and not really getting opportunities, and fights kept falling out, and I would spend 6 weeks training and then the guy would not show up or they would cancel the event. That happened a couple times. And then like I did ADCC trials one time, and I went 1-1. I lost to Jesse Ray Childrey in my second match. And like, whatever happened, but like I had an MMA fight scheduled then. So I kind of tapped to the Kimura faster than maybe I would have had I not had that MMA fight coming up. Like, he may have still Kimura'd me anyway because the dude's a beast. But like in my mind, that upset me that I gave myself an out, you know? And so then after that event, that MMA fight got canceled. Some new guy came into the gym during MMA class, and like while we were warming up, just like blasted me in between the eyes with a knee, and he like cracked my orbital bone and my forehead like lumped up, like really big, really fast. And so like just with that, man, I was out for like 6 weeks or 8 weeks or something like that. Couldn't do anything. And so like, I just didn't want to get hit again. Once that happened, you know, I was afraid to get hit a little bit. And so just talking with Richie, he was like, man, you could be really good at jiu-jitsu if you would spend all the time that you're doing like striking and stop striking at those times and start doing more jiu-jitsu or wrestling or, you know, more grappling, then you're going to be really, really good. You already competed this level and you're splitting all your time. And so I was like, you know, that does make sense. You know, I am doing pretty well, like half time being jiu-jitsu guy. And so I quit doing striking, and dude, my legs started feeling so much better because I wasn't getting kicked in like my feet and ankles from checking kicks and different things like that all day from kickboxing. So I got more mobile in my legs and stuff. So it really helped. And at brown belt, dude, I went on like a tear, trying to just compete anywhere and everywhere, and trying to beat any dude that like I could that showed up, you know, to try to get to that next level. Like there was one day I was sitting at home on a Saturday, and Richie was like, "Hey, this dude is out at this tournament. He flew in from out of town, and he wanted to be in the Ultimate Matt Warriors heavyweight tournament. Go out there and see what's up." And so I just got up off the couch and went out there and signed up and won that bracket. Submitted two guys pretty quick, and that guy included. And like, you know, just cause like I was in that mode to where it was like, all right, it's time to go. You know, like I wanted to earn my black belt. I wanted to be able to have my own school one day. I was starting to see my mortality after that MMA injury, you know, to where it's like, it's almost time to go 9 to 5 or 9 to 9 or whatever to be able to afford staying in San Diego. Cause it was really expensive. And so then from that, one of the coaches, on the staff left to try to start an MMA promotion. And when he did that, they asked me if I would fill his position. And so I did. And that's how I got on the staff. So I was teaching kickboxing, MMA, and jiu-jitsu out at 10th Planet San Diego when I was out there teaching. And then some time after I got hired is when I got promoted to black belt. So it was crazy, man. It was really like, I don't know, for the person that's doing it, and still to now, it's just normal. Like it was just what I was doing, you know. It just became life. But to a lot of people, they're like, "Oh, I can't believe you did that," you know. It's like it's a big deal, you know. But it was just what I did because it felt like it's what I needed to do to get what I wanted, you know.
And so you get your black belt, and you decide to open up a school. And you moved back to Georgia to open up 10th Planet Perry. What made you want to open up a school? What made you move back to Georgia? And I really want to know about the dream, because that's what a lot of people kind of know you. That's like your podcast. You always talk about the dream, you know, Stephen Akin, the dream. What is the dream, and what does that mean to you?
So That's a lot of different things. And so I technically got my black belt, and I didn't leave to go open my own school. Like, we had been kind of struggling a little bit financially now with the two kids, like I said, and I had like wasted a lot of our money trying to fight, and the fights didn't come. And so I couldn't pay back our money. So I'd kind of put us in a bad spot financially a little bit, chasing the dream. And so Mandy and I, we decided as a family, the best thing would be to come back over here where the cost of living was a little bit lower, and she could still do her job that she has for Geico here, just come back and do it again, you know. And so my intention wasn't necessarily to open my own school yet. I was just going to like go back to being the stay-at-home dad, and I was going to just train, probably was my plan. And then spoke to Cole Miller, who he has his school here, Miller Martial Arts. And we had trained together before, and I'd been in touch with him a lot over the years anyway, just kind of keeping up. And first I went and taught over there and was training with them again, just kind of to have something to do so I wouldn't just be out of it. But then it kind of got to the point where I really did just want to be able to do my own thing. You know, I really missed San Diego. I really missed like the vibe that the room had every day. And not that there was anything wrong with Cole's. It just was, they had their own thing. And it was just different than what I was kind of used to. Everybody trained a lot of gi, you know. They're mostly a gi heavy school. And so it was like, oh, man, if I want to train on this day, I have to go put back on the gi, which is okay. But I don't really want, you know, like I really want to stay in the system and keep getting better at the things that I'm learning, you know, that I want to within the system and stay with that. So I talked to him a little bit about it, you know, and he encouraged me to open up in Perry, which is like he's in Warner Robins. Perry's like 10 minutes south of that. So we're like 10 or 15 minutes apart. So he encouraged me just to go ahead and open up. And he said, you know, because there's space for all of us to do this. And So it was really, really, really cool to get, like, I don't want to say necessarily like his blessing, but definitely like his like pat on the back to say, yeah, go ahead and do it, that he thought it would be a successful move to make. And so that's when I really decided to reach out to Boogie and then Eddie to see like what that would mean for me to be able to get it, to have my own school. And so that's why I ended up in Perry and decided to open the school here, is because I just wanted to recreate some of what I felt like I got from San Diego, and for me to be able to. And so I guess this goes into the greater question about what all the dream stuff means. I just want to give to people the things that I think I never got. I think as a coach, I think the way that I became a good coach is because I observed a lot of coaches, and some good coaches and what they did wrong, and some bad coaches and what they did wrong. And just like over the years, just like collected data, and like that mantra of kind of like, be the person you needed when you were younger is something that I've always kind of like kept in my mind since I was a small boy. Because I had a couple coaches when I was a kid that weren't like the best guys, you know, they weren't the most motivational kind of dudes, that, and I felt like they could have really, like, with a different attitude, they could have got me to turn that corner sooner, you know? And so maybe it's good that they didn't, because now I have this drive that I have and this mentality that I have. But I just want to be able to help provide an opportunity for people to know that they can provide for themselves, that they don't have to do what everybody else tells them they have to do all the time. Like, you can chase your dream, whatever your dream is, independently. And I think getting into martial arts, and then specifically with jiu-jitsu, I really like got heavy into the philosophy and like, what is it that we're all doing? You know, like we're all out here training, right? And then there's an element of it where people are trying to be the best in the world. There's a legit group of people who are savages that are trying to win world titles, and that's all they want to do. And that's one element of what we're doing. But then there's this other element of it where it's a community, you know, and you're making friends, and you're building this environment up where people like come together and they get to know each other. And like there's like an understanding that can happen on the mats and through jiu-jitsu, you know, that I don't know that I never found it anywhere else. You know, the problem solving nature, the physical nature, the mental nature of it all, but then also, you know, just understanding why people come to jiu-jitsu, and knowing that only a small percentage of those people are trying to be a world champion. Mm. And of those people, only a small percentage of those are actually trying. And so the business model and the way to do this has not been to force everybody into that world champion box and make everybody try to be the world champion training style person. I wanted to make a space, like I said, where I felt like I felt in San Diego, to where it was welcome. You could be, you know, the freaks, you know, the outcasts, the people who didn't have a lot, the people who didn't have a cheering section when they were growing up. You know, those people are capable of doing great things, but they typically never had someone show them that it's possible, or tell them that it's possible for them to do those things. And jiu-jitsu teaches you that, right? You learn so many ways to overcome your physical and mental boundaries just through, you know, trying longer to figure out how. Sometimes it's a mental barrier that you're up against. Sometimes it's a physical barrier that you're up against. But you learn which is which and how to move through that stuff. And so, like, the dream is really like it's the American dream is what it is. You know, for me, it's my version of what I thought that meant, you know, and I know a lot of people have their own variations of what that is, you know, And then another part of that is that it's a real play on like professional wrestling and Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. Like, I'm just a big fan of that, you know, because again, like that moniker is like, for him, he's like the son of a plumber. He's this guy who, you know, came from nowhere, and through his charisma and through his efforts and everything, he you know, became one of the biggest names in his industry, and, you know, so known around the world and super successful. And, you know, he was a little chubby and overweight and stuff. So he was in there with all these really like built muscular body type people that everybody thinks the athletes are, you know, have to look like to be successful. And so like using that as a, like, I weaponized that for myself and took it away from other people, and made it like a strength for me that I was, yeah, I'm a little bit chubby, you know? Yeah, I am. And maybe I don't look like all these athletes are supposed to look in other people's opinion, but I'm a pretty bad man. You know, I'll go out here and I'll throw down with anyone, and it doesn't matter that I'm a little bit chubby. I promise that I can still get the work done, you know? And so learning that and understanding how to like come into your own personal power and to get into those, like, you know, woo-woo kind of words or whatever. You know, I spent a lot of time alone thinking about this stuff before I retired from fighting. Fighting is a lonely, like, existence if you're really trying to do it the right way, because you're just so absorbed in it that it's hard to realize what the world is like outside of that, because nobody else understands. Nobody else gets it. Nobody else is training that hard. Nobody else cares that you want to be a fighter. Not really, you know? And so you just exist in this like space that nobody else goes to except for your little group. That's what I mean, your little community of people are the only people that understand what you're going through. And so what I wanted to do is cut out the head trauma part, you know, to be honest. That's why we didn't start an MMA program here as much. Like, I have obviously a background and I could have an MMA program, but one of the biggest things is that I didn't want to keep like that going. And I didn't want to have those kind of battles going on in my gym. I wanted to have everyone working toward that goal, maybe, but in a healthy manner, to where we were really like looking out to protect each other. Even though we're going to go in here and go hard, nobody's actually looking to like damage each other. But I feel like in MMA, it's super hard to do that. It's super hard to go in there and spar and be like, all right, bro, I'm not going to hurt you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you do that? Because the intent is to hurt. The intention is to give them concussive brain damage. You know, like that's 95% of what you need to do to be a successful MMA fighter, is be able to inflict brain trauma on your opponent. So, like, I spent a lot of time being the toe for toe guy, like take one to give one, make them get tired, and then my jiu-jitsu would work a lot better. And then I had to spend a lot of time in like dark rooms without the lights on, you know, and like I went through some real severe like anger issues, and I was a little like, I don't want to say unstable to a degree that like I wasn't able to manage my life, but like emotionally I couldn't quite get the bearings on certain things after a couple times where I got like obviously concussions. And so once I started learning more about that, I really wanted to give people the opportunity, like I found, like I said, through Richie, to do this at a high level and to compete at a high level and find that, like, whatever that warrior lifestyle is, you know, where you're really sacrificing and you're training hard and you're going out there to compete and stuff, but also without having to maybe sacrifice your brain as much, you know? And so that's another part of the style that I'm trying to use at our school. It's definitely, we are not as much of a strong style school, I guess I would say. Like, overall, we're definitely more of like a technical style school where everyone is mostly learning based. You know, it's not really for, and not that it's not for athletes and people who are trying to compete. There's just very specific times where that's what we're trying to do. But most of the time, we're trying to have a good time. We're trying to have fun. We're trying to learn a new skill. And then we're all learning that at our own rate. We're all doing it at our own pace. And some people like to do it differently, you know, like that artist's approach. People paint, you know, a bunch of different ways, but it could all be beautiful, you know, and it could all be effective in its own way. So what I want to do is I come in and try to lay out, like, I guess, a blueprint of stuff. And then, like, it's up to you to build the house, right? You're the craftsman. You're the one that has to do the actual work to build your house. All I can do is give you, like, ideas and suggestions and, like, things that I know work from, like, data from the past or watching other successful people, you know. But again, going back to like the attribute based stuff, only you are able to apply that stuff or want to apply that stuff. So I want to try to make it to where it's fun to do it, because if it's fun, you'll spend more time with it. If you're miserable, you won't want to do it, you know. And like a lot of people, they're coming from work to us and they're not coming to be drilled down again. You know, they're not coming to be made feel small again, because they've just been at this job that they probably don't love or they may hate. And they're just, you know, they're just not enjoying themselves. This is the hour or hour and a half a day or an hour and a half twice a week. That's all they get. You know, this is the only time they get. So then it's my job to make sure they get the most out of that, you know, from a technical standpoint, but also from that community kind of standpoint, because that, like, truly, I think that's what most people are coming for, whether that's what they'll tell you it is or not. Because there's just not enough world champions. Not enough people are making enough money off of this to say it for any other reason. And like, I'm sure you know that. I'm sure you're rolling in the dough over there at the Grappling Discourse podcast, right?
You know, not quite yet. Not quite yet.
So, yeah, man, we do this because we love it, you know, and you do it because you love it. And you're doing this podcast because you enjoy it. And I'm talking to you because this is something that we're passionate about and we both love it. And we want to share that. I want to share that light with the world. You know, I kind of grew up in a Southern Baptist like family. And so that's a lot of like the references I have, even if I'm not as big into the church anymore or whatever. But like, I still like see that, like what I think the good Christian mindset is for people as my duty as a human, whether that's like bringing people to Jesus per se or not. Like, I just want to bring people to a better place in their lives, you know, of understanding as a whole. And hopefully through jiu-jitsu, I'm going to be able to do that.
That was very beautifully put. And it's very, very inspiring. Steven, that was kind of the final question, you know, and there's definitely some more stuff I want to talk about. So hopefully in the next couple of months, I can have you back on, because I would love to kind of talk about your coaching style the next time you're on here.
For sure.
How can people follow you? Tell them about your podcast. Where can people, you know, find more about Steven Akin and the Dream?
Yeah, so that's it, right? We're leaning into the whole Dream thing. So on Instagram, it's the Dream 10P. My name is Steven Akin. It's STEPHENEAKIN on Facebook and on YouTube. We have the Dream No Gi Camp that was coming up in Costa Rica. And like the idea for that, again, just like, I didn't know where this is going or where it's going to even end up now, but like, we're going to supply some mats to the local community to be able to do jiu-jitsu on, you know, so it's going to be really cool to be able to do that kind of stuff. That's the Dream No Gi Camp. We're doing that in October. So if you want to follow the Dream No Gi Camp for like the next things that are coming up, we're going to be really excited to keep pushing forward with that. otherwise, I guess if I have a second, I would just really like to say, if you can go, please donate to the Zach Edwards GoFundMe at Country Leg Locks BJJ. That's something that's really been heavy on my heart the last week. Once they diagnosed him with the brain cancer. And so anybody that, like, if you have anything you can donate or whatever, there's also a raffle that is going on Tex_Jitsu on Instagram, with some prizes, including a free space at our camp in October. Like, you'd have to get your own travel and accommodations, but like the training part of it and all is included. So we threw that in just to try to see if anything would, to help boost that. But there's several other prizes that they're giving away on that. I'm not sure exactly when it closes, but definitely, like, that would be one of the bigger missions that I would like to get everybody's attention to right now. And I think, again, that's what we need to do as a community and as like a tribe, is to take care of our people, especially when they're in a situation when they can't really take care of themselves.
Donate, people. Zach is one of the most genuine guys I've met in the community, and what's going on with him is truly heartbreaking, and I know he's going to pull through it, but he definitely needs our support. So thank you, Stephen, for bringing that up, and I think it's just awesome what you're doing. Everything you've got going on is very inspiring.
I appreciate it, dude. Thank you.
Well, that's it. Until next time, ladies and gents, we are out. Peace.